Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. As we head into the Labor Day weekend, a conversation on a bit of Oklahoma nostalgia. For lifelong Oklahomans of a certain age, we can all remember an animal that was fairly common with a name as varied as its number. As my guest today writes, it's been called a lizard, a frog, or a toad, horned, horn, or horny. But by any name, the Texas horned lizard, better known around these parts as the horny toad, is the stuff of folk tales, regional pride, school mascots, and the memorable menagerie of countless Oklahoma childhoods. Unfortunately, the numbers of horny toads are declining, especially in the eastern half of the state. And in Oklahoma Today's latest issue, the animal issue, it prompted the question, whatever happened to the horny toad? My guest today is Woodward, Oklahoma freelance writer and journalist Chad Love. He's the contributor to the magazine, author of that article, who tried to answer that question. He joins me today on Studio Tulsa. Chad Love, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Your article on whatever happened to the horny toad, featured in this month's issue of Oklahoma Today, really struck a chord with me, because I think for many native Oklahomans of a certain age, I think, they remember horny toads as being sort of a part of the landscape, and especially as you move west of Tulsa, a common occurrence to see these creatures, and now you hear nothing about it. So what gave you the idea about writing about the horny toad?
Well, actually, I can't claim credit for the idea. That was an idea that Nathan Gunner, the editor at the magazine, approached me with, but once he told me about it, I was all for it, because I'm sort of a lifelong reptile and amphibian fan. Grew up in the Norman Noble area, and so I grew up catching lizards and snakes and frogs and turtles and horny toads, and so it sort of appealed to me, not only from a journalistic standpoint to be able to sort of chronicle the story, but also it sort of tugged at my heartstrings too, the same way that it does with everyone else, in terms of this, you know, having a connection with this sort of iconic creature from their childhood.
Now, have you been surprised at how many people have had this sort of reaction that I did? Because I'd be surprised if there weren't, because of a certain age, you know, my brother was quite a bit older than me. And when I was a little kid, he actually had a little habitat that he had built. It was like a big, huge sandbox with some, you know, mesh wiring on the top. And he actually had horned lizards as pets back then. Now, that's illegal now, but I don't think it was back in the 60s.
Yeah, it's a creature that everyone seems to recall. Everyone kind of has a connection to it. And I don't know if a lot of that is part of sort of a cultural shift. People of my generation and older generations maybe spent more time outside, and younger generations maybe don't spend as much time outside and have that connection with you know, sort of getting in the dirt and finding horny toads and everything. But especially among older people old enough to remember horny toads, it really brings back memories.
So have the numbers really declined? What's the situation with the animal's viability here in the state?
Well, yeah, I think that it's a fact that they have declined. In Oklahoma, at least according to, you know, Mark Howery at the Oklahoma Department of Wildlife Conservation, who was a part of the story, said that, you know, traditionally or historically, horny toads are the Texas horned lizard or whatever you call it. It's got a number of
horned frog,
names, horned frogs, horned lizards. But for the, I always called it a horny toad, so that's what I generally, that's my default name. The horny toad occupied the western four-fifths of the state, and it has declined fairly dramatically in the eastern half of the state. In the western half of the state, they say that the populations are still fairly stable, and there are a lot of reasons for that. Better habitat in the western part of the state, not as much development. But especially in central Oklahoma, in the urban areas, Oklahoma City, metro area, Norman, more that area, they've declined a lot. And a lot of that is due to things like housing developments, introduction of non-native species, non-native plants. And so there is a decline, a real decline in horny-toed numbers. Perhaps not quite as much as what some people think, but it definitely is there.
As I think about it, I lived in areas where we were on the edge of town, and so that creature had natural habitat very nearby. What's happened is you see sprawls and towns have gotten larger, and also you've seen a lot more use of, I guess from what you wrote, that the use of fescue and Bermuda grasses for whether it's, for pasture land or for lawns and things, that's been a real, has led to a real decline in their numbers. They can't forage on that.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the things that that was kind of a revelation to me in writing the story, is that I always knew about the connection between the red harvester ant and Texas horned lizards. You know, ants make up the bulk of the horny toad's diet. And so, but especially in talking to Ray Moody at Tinker and the biologist at Tinker who's conducting the study there, and Mark Howery, really it goes down one more level to the ant's forage base and the ant's habitat requirements, because native ants primarily subsist on native forbs and broadleaf weeds. And so what happens is that, you move in, you get housing developments come in and take that habitat that was at one time, native prairie, and then they convert that to Bermuda and fescue and apply herbicides and pesticides. And so what that does is that displaces ants. And so, of course, the ants are the main food base for the horny toad. And so it just sort of becomes a self-perpetuating cycle from the ground up.
And when you wrote about that's something else that used to be pretty ubiquitous around a lot of part of Oklahoma, and that would be red harvester ants. These are what I assume what we would call red ants.
Red ants, yes.
They sort of make a sort of a raised pile. They're large ants. They do bite and sting if you run afoul of them.
Yes, but I guess do. The bane of many an Oklahoma childhood.
Yes, right.
The red ants, and that's true. That's that makes up the bulk of a lot of horny toads' diets, and they have the red ants. You don't see red ants nearly as much as you used to, but due to the widespread use of herbicides and pesticides.
Yeah, and also I think the fire ant scare as well. Sort of people would confuse them with fire ants, and really go out of their way to eradicate their nests.
Yeah. Now, where I live in Woodward, fire ants aren't really a problem, but I know that they're becoming a problem in northern Texas, southern Oklahoma,
yeah.
And that's another one of the sort of contributing factors to the horny toad's decline is the introduction of fire ants. They outcompete native ants. Horny toads don't seem to like them; they don't eat them, and so when you have fire ants come into an area and basically replace the food base for the horny toad, then the horny toads go away.
So the status of the horned lizard here in the state, it's not necessarily endangered, threatened, but it's somewhere in between.
Yeah, it's what they call it. I think it's called a species of special concern. And it's, like you said, it's not endangered on the state level. I do think that it's classified that in Texas, but in Oklahoma, it's not. But it is this species of special concern, and there is a close season on it. You can't collect them. You can't keep them as pets. The days of kids going out and collecting a horny toad as a pet are gone, which was a horrible idea to begin with.
Right.
They do make horrible pets. Mark Howery at the Wildlife Department said that the populations are stable in areas that still have the habitat. And so I think the goal is to try to keep the populations sort of at least where they are in terms of their numbers.
Now, you found a really interesting population within the state, and it's located in perhaps a place that totally makes sense when you think about it. But at first glance, you would think, what on earth is that? Why are they there? And it's at Tinker Air Force Base in Midwest City.
Yes. Yeah, that's a really interesting story because at first glance, you wouldn't think that there would be horny toads on an Air Force base. But apparently there are. There are large tracts of tinker that are fairly undeveloped and turns out to be fairly good habitat for horny toads. And so the natural resources biologist at Tinker, Ray Moody, started a study of the horny toads there on the base, and I think it was about 14 years ago. And so he's been doing that ever since. And it's a really interesting twist on the horny toad story because, you know, you have this sort of a fairly isolated population of horny toads in the middle of this island of habitat in a sea of development all around it. And so it gives them a fairly unique opportunity to study them. It's about a 30-acre site there on the base where the majority of the horny toad habitat is. And what he does, he partners with both, I believe, ODWC and also the Oklahoma City Zoo in this study. And they go out and they radio collar or radio tag horny toads and study their movements, study their habitat requirements. And so some of the research can be used in larger studies, and other states are looking at the at what's going on at Tinker to try to apply some of the findings to their own horny toad research and conservation efforts. One of the things that they found was that horned lizards don't particularly make very good transplants. Mm. They're kind of homebodies. They stay in the same, they like the same area. And when you transplant them, they don't really do as well. They have a routine that they have their own defined little area, and when you take them out of that, Moody described it as they kind of get confused, and so that makes they travel more, and so that makes them open to predation and other things. And so that's one of the things that they found over the course of the study was that that Texas horned lizards are not good transplants, and so they're trying to find ways to not really alleviate that, but try to work around that in reintroducing horned toads in other areas.
Now, so they're not really particularly adaptable to mobility. So with habitat reduction, if they lose their habitat, they really can't move to the next patch of prairie where their food source is available.
Right. Yeah.
And
fragmentation.
Cover.
Yeah. Fragmentation of habitat is a big problem for horned toads because they are not very mobile creatures. And so when you have habitat fragmentation, things like housing developments and other development, then they can't really adapt to that like other creatures can, like even other lizards or the other wildlife. They just sort of disappear.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned the Oklahoma City Zoo is working with Tinker Air Force Base. You report a little bit on what the zoo's doing to learn more about horned lizards.
Yeah, one of the things that they're doing with the zoo is that they're partnering with the zoo to create ways to move hatchling horned lizards into new areas to see if they do better as adults. Because one of the findings that from the study is that adult horned lizards don't do well as transplants. So they're trying to see if young hatchling horned lizards being introduced into a new habitat will fare any better than the adults. And so that's kind of a cool thing.
Yeah, not knowing much about how they work, do horned, and you may not know the answer to this, but do horny toads, after they're hatched, do they have a sort of a learning process with their parents, or are they pretty much on their own pretty quick?
I think they're, I don't know for sure, I'm just assuming, yeah. But I think they're probably pretty much on their own from birth. I think most reptiles are kind of like that way.
Yeah.
Are kind of like that. And I think horny toads are probably the same way, but I'm really not qualified to answer.
My guest today is Chad Love. He's a freelance journalist and a contributor to Oklahoma Today over the years. And his story, Whatever Happened to the Horny Toad, is featured prominently in Oklahoma Today's latest issue, the September-October issues, which is devoted to animals. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, you also quote extensively from the Department of Wildlife Conservation, and when I think of the Department of Wildlife Conservation, I really think of their focus on game species. How much research do they do on animals that are not really considered game animals, the horny toad?
As much as they can with the limited resources that they have, you know, the wildlife department is funded primarily through the sale of hunting and fishing licenses. So that is their primary focus. However, they do have wildlife diversity program at the department, and they do a great job of not only, you know, research but also promoting the non-game species found in Oklahoma. And so one of the things, I'll give a little pitch to the Wildlife Department plate program. One of the ways that they fund that is through the sale of the Wildlife Department plates that you can get. You know, they've got, I think they have a horny-toed plate and, yeah, and other animals. And so that the money from that goes to the non-game program. They do get some grant money and, you know, money from other sources. There's also a tax checkoff program that you can donate your part of your state income tax return to, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so those are the primary ways that they get money for their programs.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, interesting things, that it was, I probably because of length, it may have got edited a little bit, but it was really interesting on why this species is important to a lot of people. And there's this little quote that really caught my eye that, and it was a person talking about shifting baseline syndrome and why this particular creature is important to Oklahomans. And I guess it's about how you have this baseline of your environment around you, and then when something's gone, it sort of shifts that baseline. Explain this shifting baseline syndrome.
Yeah, and of course, it's a biological term, and so as a layman, I'm probably butchering the real meaning of it. But basically, what it is, shifting baseline syndrome, is a process by which, you know, successive generations have an idea of what is normal, and then as time progresses and things change, you know, 50 years from now, what is normal could be completely different from what was normal from a historical perspective. And so people kind of it's basically a loss of perspective. And I think a lot of times that's sort of what happens with the horny toad, is that people remember something from their childhood. And that's why I think that you see a lot of reminiscing and nostalgia about the horny toad from people who are old enough to remember it. But when you talk to younger people, especially, you know, people, you know, teenagers, people in their 20s, you know, sometimes the 30s, there's not as strong a connection to the horny toad because there's not that sort of collective or shared memory about it. And so that's one of those interesting kind of things that happens as these creatures either disappear either from our collective memory or from the environment.
And you think about that on a larger scale. It's like, so if you grew up, say, in Beijing in the early 1900s, you recognized, you know, before the vast industrialization of China, Beijing was a place where you would have clear skies. And now, you know, Beijing is, you know, one of the most seriously polluted cities in the world. A young Chinese person growing up may think of all that pollution as being normal, and that sort of changes the viewpoint on fixing it.
yeah, basically it does. And the same thing happens in Oklahoma. I mean, you have people who say, you know, I never see horny toads anymore. Well, okay, they're standing in a Bermuda grass yard in a subdivision. They've got ornamental, you know, non-native plants in their yard. And of course they're not going to see horny toads anymore because they, you know, we have totally changed the landscape that horny toads need in order to survive.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. Some of the people that I talked to during the course of the story, when they talk to people who always say, well, we never see horny toads anymore. There's not skepticism about that, but several people mentioned that, you know, actually I think that there might be more horny toads out there than what people think, in the areas that still have stable populations. But people don't get out and see them anymore because as a culture, we're not nearly as outdoors oriented as we used to be, especially children. There are fewer children who go outdoors and play and root around in the dirt. And so there's that sometimes I think tends to skew the perception mm-hmm. of of those animals and their, you know, their populations.
Well, I had my own shifting baseline syndrome not too long ago. I was in St. Louis at the St. Louis Zoo, and it had this incredible bird display back from that goes back to the 1904 World's Fair, and there was a bobwhite quail who was just, you know, trumpeting out the bobwhite over and over again, and that was a sound that I grew up with every night, because again I grew up on the outside of the town really, and there was a lot of native habitat around, and I grew up hearing that sound. I don't know, it was almost like a sort of a primordial reaction of something that I hadn't heard for so long.
Yeah, and actually,
as a city dweller,
you mentioned bobwhite quail, is that as it turns out, there is the bobwhite quail and the Texas horned lizard share a lot of the same habitat requirements, which I thought was interesting. They both require, fairly large tracts of native habitat. They require sort of a mosaic of different types of habitats within that larger habitat. They both require, native broadleaf weeds and forbs for survival. And so yeah, there is that sort of link between the bobwhite and the horny toad that I hadn't thought of before. And so it's interesting you say that.
Now, is there much effort at habitat restoration for species like, say, even the bobwhite quail or a horned toad or a variety of sort of species that depend on native grasses and plants and animals that need that to survive?
Mm-hmm. Well, I asked Mark Howery about that, about any specific programs for habitat restoration for the horned toad. And he said they don't really do any of that. They're just trying to keep populations stable in the areas where the horned toad is still prevalent. However, you know, there are some things you can do in terms of acquiring more habitat. You know, one of the things that you could do is actually buy a hunting or fishing license. And even though the Wildlife Department, the bulk of that money that the Wildlife Department gets through hunting and fishing licenses goes to the operation of the department, they also use a lot of that, some of that money to acquire new properties, new wildlife management areas. And wildlife management areas they manage those for wildlife. And so when you buy a wildlife management area, say in western Oklahoma, you know, that's a net gain for horny toads as well as you know, game species like bobwhite quail, white-tailed deer, things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of an indirect kind of thing. You know, they don't have any specific programs that they're working on for you know, habitat restoration of the horny toad, but it's all sort of an indirect thing.
Now, if people see a horny toad, the Wildlife Conservation Department actually encouraged them to call them so they know where the populations are, especially, I would think, on the eastern side of the state, because the fear is that this animal has been eliminated from, say, about a fifth or maybe two-fifths of the eastern side of its habitat.
Yeah, it's called the Wildlife Diversity Citizen Science Program. And so what you can do is you can go online and report that horned lizard sighting, and that gives them just another data point in the research and the programs that they're doing with the horny toad.
All right. Well,
and you can find that on their website. I don't have the address right now, but they can go to the Wildlife Department website and find it.
All right. Well, Chad, it's a really great article, and it's some great pictures, too, by your collaborator on the story. And it just brought back so many memories for me as a native Oklahoman, I know for you too, as well as a native Oklahoman, about this particular little animal that sort of has made a big impact on some of us. The story is titled "Whatever Happened to the Horny Toad." Chad, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Chad Love is a freelance journalist and a contributor to Oklahoma Today magazine. His story, "Whatever Happened to the Horny Toad," is featured in this month's issue of Oklahoma Today, devoted to animals. It's the animals issue. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Connie Cronley.
There's a mean wind blowing across the country, and everywhere it goes, it picks up dirt and debris. An activity that's popular right now is piling on. Say something, say anything, and people will pile on. Here are the rules. Be mad. You don't have to be informed or knowledgeable, just pile on. Piling on is second cousin to chicken pecking. That's when chickens turn mean and attack one weak or sick chicken. I looked this up, and it's called picking. And it happens when a flock is stressed. A wise chicken wrangler said, happy chickens don't pick one another. But aggressive chickens bully their way to the top by pecking others into submission. I know this from experience. I have been a recent victim of picking. I reposted what I thought was an interesting article about our federal wild horses policy. I personally have no opinion and less knowledge about wild horses, but I thought it was interesting that some Oklahoma ranchers are paid millions in taxpayer dollars for privately pasturing wild horses. Oh my God, did people pile on. Some accuse me of attacking the pioneer woman, that beloved cook of Osage County, who happens to be a rancher's wife. I fled like the social media coward I am. Now, I could have defended myself. I could have said, are you kidding? Her grandmother was my teacher in Nowata. No way I'm going to disrespect Mrs. Leffler's granddaughter, even if her husband does pasture wild horses. Which brings me to NPR's July 4th annual broadcasting of the Declaration of Independence. This year, tweeting the Declaration of Independence was added, and here came the angry hordes, picking and piling on. They didn't recognize that it was the Declaration of Independence. They thought it was an attack on President Trump. I had no part in that brouhaha. But this year, one phrase in the Declaration caught my ear for the first time. It was among the listing of the grievances against tyranny of King George III of Great Britain, withholding assent of local laws, cutting off trade, imposing taxes, maintaining a standing army, and then this. Exciting domestic insurrections on the frontiers by the merciless Indian savages. Whoa! Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, and others of the committee used the term merciless Indian savages in the Declaration of Independence in 1776? Yes, and it took us a long time to get past that. Congress didn't grant citizenship to Native Americans in the United States until 1924. I sent a long email of lamentation to my go-to guy for all things Native American, Dr. Renard Strickland, the renowned expert on Indian law. He told me, in short, to calm down. That since he and I are both enrolled citizens of the Cherokee Nation, which is what is termed one of the five civilized tribes, our families were declared U.S. citizens in 1907 with Oklahoma statehood, a full 131 years after being libeled as merciless and savage. Oh, brother! I call your attention to the poem by Philip Appleman that begins, Karma, Dharma, pudding and pie, give me a break before I die.
Connie Cronley is a freelance writer, an author, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.